but I can live on $80,000.
You get that from Slate?
I've given that up, and I don't think it's coming back.
Right.
But because salaries are going down, not up.
Sure.
But
because of those unskilled Mexican bloggers. Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie for Reason TV. Today we're talking to Mickey Kouse, the proprietor of the Kouse Files, one of the creators of Blogging Heads, and now a Senate candidate from California. You're running against Barbara Boxer for the Democratic nomination.
Correct.
Why are you doing that, Mickey?
The basic reason is because I could. California is not one of those East Coast states where you need 100,000 signatures from party regulars to get on the ballot. You need 65 signatures.
Right. And they can even be illegal immigrants?
No. 65, it's a little harder than you think because you're only allowed to submit 100, so of those, 65 have to be good. So you have to actually check out every one of those and make sure that they're not illegal, but are Democrats registered and they live at the address you gave. So it's not that easy, but it's
What was your hit rate? Did you get 100 out of 100? Or
no. They stopped when they hit 70.
Okay.
So they told me
so
I had 70.
Pretty good.
I may have had you.
Let's, one of your big issues related to Barbara Boxer, has to do with immigration.
Yeah. Right. I do have a serious rationale for the candidacy, which is I think the Democratic Party has been captured by its interest groups.
It's
a fairly common analysis, but the unions are the main one.
Right.
They sort of own the Democratic Party, especially at the state level,
much
more so than the national level. They own the Democratic Party in California.
Which unions in particular?
Well, the big ones are the teachers' unions and the SEIU, but there's some very powerful ones like the IBEW, basically runs the L.A. Department of Water and Power.
And that's actually the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers.
So
what about the prison guards in California?
Prison guards are very important. The Indian casinos are very important, but they're like Wall Street. They've bought both parties.
Right.
So they're not really peculiarly Democratic.
There is effectively no Republican Party in California anymore, right?
No, there is one.
Yeah.
It's up for grabs. It's a very weak party structure in any case.
Right.
Because both parties are weak, and the Republicans maybe are even weaker than the Democrats. But there's nothing left except the unions. And that's the only structure there is.
Okay. Democrats have been captured by their interest groups, particularly the unions.
But there's this pandering to the Latino lobby. There's a big Latino caucus in the legislature, and they have immense power.
What constitutes pandering to Latinos?
Well, I think comprehensive immigration reform, which is what's is in the news now.
Right.
Obama keeps threatening to revive it, and then he pulls back, and then he threatens again. Which is a combination of amnesty and enforcement, is a terrible idea. We tried that in '86; it failed. The amnesty works, and the enforcement fails under legal assault from the ACLU and Chamber of Commerce and MALDEF and various people. So we amnestied all the people who were here before '86. Then we got another 12 million illegals coming in after that. Amnesty is a surefire draw to people if you were living in Latin America, and somebody said they're giving amnesty in America, you'd say, maybe I'll go there and get the next amnesty. So it's pandering to propose something that's bad for America solely to attract votes.
What was the negative outcome of the 1986 immigration reform?
The negative outcome is we have 12 million illegals, so we're now trying to figure out what to do with it.
It's a
real problem.
Why is it a problem?
It's a problem because here's the way I like to look at it, okay? Why not have open borders?
Mm-hmm.
Nice, it's sort of a libertarian idea.
Yeah, very much.
People want to come here. They want to work.
Right.
They're not a threat to national security. You know, they don't carry
you're
diseases.
You're describing a horrifying vision of the future.
Let them come here, you know, and borders are arbitrary, national constraints anyway. There are two reasons. Half the world would move here. And that would, three reasons actually.
Okay.
Half the world move here. It would drive down wages for unskilled Americans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wrote a book called The End of Equality about how to be a liberal when incomes are growing more unequal and there's nothing you can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
The reason there's nothing you can do about it is because in the global economy, people without skills in industrialized countries do very badly because that work is done in India or Bangladesh or somewhere else. So their only hope is that there will be enough jobs that have to be done in America that wages will stay at a decent level. if even those jobs are done by the rest of the world pouring into America, those people, especially, people who are rising out of poverty, for example, people we wanted to leave the welfare rolls and go to work, those wages will be dirt now. So you won't be able to be an unskilled American and make a decent wage.
How does that square with,
the two other things, there'll be vast inequality. I mean, my whole book was designed to say we shouldn't worry about inequality.
Right.
But, and then Bob Shrum, the Democratic consultant, said, well, have you ever gone to Latin America? Latin America, if you're middle class, you live in, or rich, you live in an apartment building and there's a guy with a machine gun on every floor. I don't want to live in that kind of society. We would immediately have the inequalities of Rio de Janeiro and Los Angeles. We'd have immediately in historical terms. In 10, 20 years, I think. I think in 10, 20 years, L.A. would look like Rio de Janeiro. Mm-hmm. There'd be huge slums. Rich people would have to hire people with machine guns to defend them. That's not what we want America to look like. Mm-hmm. And the third thing, which is very controversial, which you can't bring up, we're right next door to Mexico. Mm-hmm. 50% of our illegal immigrants are from Mexico. Right. In any other place in the world, you would say that's a recipe for trouble, to have huge influxes of Mexicans living in an area that's adjacent to Mexico. One day they may want to be part of Mexico, or they want more of an affiliation with Mexico.
So you do worry about Reconquista.
Reconquista is a little extreme. If you talk to people in Mexico, I'm told if you get them drunk in a bar, they'll say, we're taking it back, sorry.
Right.
That's not an uncommon sentiment in Mexico, so why can't we take it seriously here?
Do we worry about Germany taking back America?
No, Germany is the next door, Nick.
Okay.
These people are next door. This is like a Quebec problem if France was next door to Canada.
Let's run through these real quick. Immigration is the linchpin of your senatorial
I have two linchpins. Okay. One is the unions have too much power, both in the Democratic Party, the government, and the economy.
Okay.
They don't have that much power in the economy, but the Democrats want to give them more power by making it easier to organize.
For instance, in New York State, when Spitzer was able to elect a Democratic legislature, and then even though he evacuated, I mean, we see what happens when unions gain more power in a state legislature.
Well, in every state and community in the country, unions are in the process of bankrupting
government. Let's talk about that in a second. First, the 3 points on immigration. Question. During the 90s and most of the 2000s, immigrants went to places that had lower than average unemployment because they go looking for jobs. They don't go to places with sick economies.
Right.
How did, say, San Francisco not benefit from an influx of immigrants, whether it's legal immigrants from other parts of the U.S. or from Mexico?
Well,
crime rates did not go up. Welfare rolls did not go up. Most illegals in particular are kept from being on welfare rolls.
Well, I am not one who stresses that illegals lead to crime and welfare and bankrupt the state. But they definitely had a bad effect on education.
In what way?
Because they don't speak English, a lot of them, and you had to go. You had to send your kids to class with people who didn't speak English, and as a result, there was a demand for bilingual programs that only recently we managed
to get rid of
a bit.
With the help of Latinos.
Right. Yep. Right. No, but it's still, if you have a kid, you would rather he goes to school with people who already speak English, so you don't get that out of the way. Yep. No matter how noble and hardworking the non-English speakers are.
Sadly, you're talking to somebody whose mother didn't speak English until she went to grammar school, and I'm not sure she was speaking English at the end of her life either. But immigrants did not cause an unemployment problem. They did not. People did not lose wages.
People did lose wages.
No. At a very, very small level, because the level of unskilled workers. Who was cutting the grass in California before Mexicans?
All economists agree. Overall, whatever happens with immigration, maybe it benefits society.
It's a huge benefit.
Certainly benefits the rich.
Even George Borjas.
Certainly benefits the rich.
Yes.
Benefits overall, but it hurts those at the bottom of the wage scale. Classic example, people who put up drywall. A very common job for unskilled blacks in L.A. Used to pay, I'm told, about twice what it pays now. Okay? That's a big hit, and those are the people the Democratic Party should be helping. That's why I'm not for it.
Is the better way to help them not to stop immigration? Because it's not simply a case of saying, okay, we're going to stop it, we'll turn a switch, that's it. You have to put into a huge infrastructure, including a wall, including enforcement, including all sorts of drags on the economy. Why not give black Americans better access to education? So that they already speak English, they can move up the skill ladder, right?
But there will always be somebody at the bottom of the skill ladder, and society has to incorporate those people, too, and ensure that those people have a decent life. And the only way to do it is to get the situation we had at the end of the 90s, best 5 years black America has ever had. Mm-hmm. We had a tight labor market. You remember.
We also had a lot of immigration, and people were worried about illegal immigration. I mean, so it doesn't seem to me that immigration is
the issue. If you could control immigration, you can get a tight labor market even when the economy is not booming.
How do you I don't know about that.
I'm not saying stop immigration forever. I'm saying we just want to have control of it.
Okay, so we let them in when we can, when we get absorbed, and we don't let them in when we can.
And
then there's the other question of whether or not will American cities start to look like South American cities? And I would argue, you notice South American cities look the way they do, even though they're not big on immigration, right? I mean, so it's like it may be something that has to do with South American social structures, political, economic structures, rather than American ones, which have been on and off, you know, accepting huge numbers of immigrants and generally creating a pretty open society.
If you go to San Diego, you'll see the beginnings of the Latin American-style cities in America.
But you won't necessarily in places like Chicago, which is a huge destination for immigrants, or New York City. I mean, I'm wondering whether or not what you're describing is also recognize that Southern California has a particular set of issues that don't necessarily translate even to Texas.
Well, but you're talking about why not have open borders. Half of Mexico would move here. So we'd have a lot of Mexicans here.
What do you base that on? If illegal immigration, one of the arguments about it is that we're not protecting the border. Anybody who can come here is coming here. How much more would
coming here. But a huge chunk of Mexico is already here.
Yeah.
I forget what the figure is, but
what do you do to control the border that doesn't turn us into another type of Latin American dictatorship where we're showing papers, where everybody has to be registered in a worker database, where, you know, you given a little son, me given a little son, we're pretty swarthy. Are we showing papers everywhere? I mean, how do you control?
I have papers in my pocket. If a cop stops me on the street driving my car, I'm going to have to show him papers. We've already crossed the papers threshold.
Okay, verification for work. Once you're in the U.S., you should be able to be stopped by police at any point in order to verify your citizenship.
I don't think at any point. You have to have some. This Arizona law, for example, that just passed.
You're for it?
I want to give it a try. Mm-hmm. It seems to me it does not. If I thought it would lead to police sweeping through Mexican areas and asking everybody for their papers, I'd be against it. I'm for letting the people who are in the shadows stay in the shadows. Let them live their lives in peace. But I don't think it'll happen. They have to have a reason to stop you, and then they can ask for your papers.
Okay, and one of the reasons will become whether or not you don't seem to be a citizen.
No, that's not it. They have to come up with some excuse. They have to say what they say to me when they stop me. Your tail light's out. Okay.
Can you point to a time, and I mean this isn't facetious, where a heavily militarized border, typically with fence wall checkpoints, led to a flourishing society and a free economy?
Well, sure.
Yeah.
A free economy. Israel is one example.
Okay.
They have a wall. Not only they're not just stopping honest, hardworking, illegal immigrants. They're trying to stop people with bombs who are trying to kill them. Mm-hmm. It seems to work.
Are you equating
Israel's economy is flourishing behind its wall?
Are you equating illegal immigrants?
No, but you just
here
you,
and work.
You just said walls didn't work, and I'm saying here's an example where it worked.
For a place.
Here's an example where it worked.
So Israel would be a model.
Great Wall of China worked for a couple of centuries.
The Great Wall of China was also designed as much to keep people in, peasants and serfs in, so that they paid for the building of the wall, right?
So I thought there was something with the Mongol hordes.
What do you do with the 12 million illegals here?
Well, they're a problem. You just said, what was the bad effect of the 86 law? The bad effect is we now have this problem of 12 million illegals.
No, but what do you do? I disagree.
What do I do with them? What do we do with them? I think you... I know a lot of real right-wingers, and when you get them drunk in bars, they will tell you most of these people are going to get to stay. They're not going to be deported. We need to take effective border control measures and have some legal mechanism for unskilled workers to come from Mexico as a safety valve.
How many unskilled workers should be allowed into the country? But if you're talking about cutting off the supply.
The bias should be more towards skilled, but we need unskilled workers too. I can see that unskilled immigrants make Los Angeles run. I live in Los Angeles. You can't live in Los Angeles and not appreciate the contribution of these people. Right. So that's no dispute there. We need some of them. I don't know, would we have like 450,000 immigrants a year? Mm-hmm. I don't know what percentage are unskilled. But the point is we should do that, secure the border, send the message to the world that the game has changed. Mm-hmm. You can't just come to America, and if you can get past the border, you'll get a job. Once we've done that, let MALDEF sue, let the ACLU sue, let the Chamber of Commerce sue to stop whatever mechanisms we have. You can sue.
Would you get rid of birthright citizenship?
And then wait a few years, and then we could talk about amnesty once we've set the message.
Okay. Although you argued that the 86 immigration reform was a failure precisely because of amnesty.
Right. But they tried to do them at the same time, and one worked. The amnesty worked, and the enforcement didn't. I'm saying the enforcement worked. Wait until we're sure it works, and then probably the best solution is to let the people who are still here stay here legally.
Would you get rid of birthright citizenship?
I think birthright citizenship is sort of a crazy idea. I mean, people sneak across the border and have
so
a kid in San Diego.
So is freedom of the press, right?
No, freedom of the press is a good idea. The idea that you sneak across the border
by accident.
Let me put
it this way. It's a unique thing to America, seriously. I mean, the First Amendment is one of the defining characteristics of America. Isn't birthright citizenship? There's virtually no other country in the world that has that.
I take your word for it, but it's a little wacky in if you're trying to discourage illegal immigration to say, but if you can make it to America and have a kid across the Rio Grande, suddenly you're home free. Now, it does have, because what happens then is you can't, the parent gets to stay here too, because who's going to throw out the parent of an illegal American citizen? So that's why they're called anchor babies, and I know people whose gardeners have wives have snuck across the Rio Grande and had a baby, and that's how they solve their problem. So it happens.
Do you take issue with the Pew Hispanic Center published a report 2 years ago saying that by the third generation in the country, that a vast majority, it was something like 75 or 85% of Hispanic households are English dominant? Which is a way of talking about assimilation.
There were also some scary findings in that survey.
I mean,
there was a huge percentage did not think of themselves as Americans first, thought of themselves as
No, you are
Latino,
of the Jewish
Chicanos
persuasion.
Do you, I guarantee you,
you
I did not think of myself as
no,
a Jew
No, I wasn't
first.
Asking you, but, and I say this as somebody who is, from my mother's side was Italian. They considered themselves American, but Italian as well, even if they had never.
Oh,
been
that's
to
fine.
LA.
But the question is, which are you first?
Do you think that
primary affiliation?
Do you think that Mexicans in particular are not assimilating into an American
in that sense? In that sense, less than other groups, because they can go home in a day. I mean, and this is a standard point made by the pro amnesty people, that there used to be a circular flow.
Right.
People would go all around. Yeah. So obviously, if you spend part of the year in Mexico and go back and forth across the border, you're going to retain your Mexican identity longer than my parents. Well, you asked, is it slower?
Okay.
Do they take longer to form an American identity? I think yes, for logical reasons. You would too.
Okay.
If Germany was right next door,
that's a problem.
It's a potential problem, yes, because there's going to be some crazy. If you go to the demonstrations, there's one tomorrow, there's one every May Day. If you go to the demonstrations, you'll see these signs saying, "I am already in my homeland." Okay, those are people who don't see themselves as Americans, and some crazy group of them is going to be like the Basque terrorists. They're going to want to rejoin Mexico.
Do you think that they'll become terrorists? Violent separatists.
I do not think the vast majority of people here want to rejoin Mexico. They're escaping Mexico.
Yeah.
But enough of them will that it'll be trouble.
Yeah. Okay.
That's all.
How does this play with your Mexican friends?
I don't talk to my Mexican friends about it. I have no friends at all, so you've solved that.
Yes.
I'm a blogger.
Yeah.
I work a lot.
The only Mexican guys I know are the guys who play in my softball league.
They're all trying to break into the entertainment business.
Right.
We don't talk about about immigration.
Okay. How does your position on immigration advance, or how is it different than the Democratic, than Barbara Boxer's or other Democratic candidates?
Well, Boxer is for, quote, comprehensive reform, which is this combination of simultaneous amnesty and border border security, which you should oppose, too, because there's a border security
element.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I'm not for that. I'm for trying the border security. Wait 5 years, see if it works, and then talk about amnesty.
Let's talk about unions. How are they bankrupting the country?
Well, there are a bunch of different problems related to unions. They're not bankrupting the private sector, though they did bankrupt General Motors. So
and they're not bankrupting the private sector because they're no longer a factor in the private sector.
Right, right. But they, where they exist, they do not seem to have a very good effect on efficiency.
Right.
The way I see it, I do think unions have done a lot for people, but I think they're a form that has now outlived its usefulness.
Right.
What unions do is they give workers democratically the right to choose a bargaining representative who's then their exclusive representative. That's the whole shtick. That's the whole key to unionism. What are going to be their first demands of an honest democratic workforce? They're going to demand, you can't fire me without notice in a hearing, because we don't want arbitrary firings. And when people gather in a group, they say, we don't want to make invidious distinctions by merit. We want promotion by seniority and layoff by seniority. Two perfectly reasonable things that happen to be terrible for an organization that wants to succeed, because the due process hearings for firings inevitably become cumbersome, and you basically give up firing people. Promotion by seniority means you only have to do well enough not to get fired, and you'll advance. There's no incentive to doing really well. So General Electric would not be General Electric if it had these two policies.
Right.
So right off the bat, unions do not contribute to productivity. And the question is, what all do they do that's so good that compensates for this effect? And I don't see it anymore. I mean, if you're a coal miner, you need a union. I can see that. If you're a worker at General Motors, you know, I don't think the potential
for
abuse is...
What about if you're a school teacher? I mean, because that's where the unions are now, right? It's prison guards, it's cops, it's school teachers.
Public employees is a much worse situation. Public employees, you know, if a private sector union asks for too much and the company gives it to them, the company will disappear as half of General Motors disappeared.
Yeah.
That incentive or disincentive doesn't have impact in the private in the public sector.
Right.
All the union has to do is get some politician to vote a tax increase to pay the increased salary, and boom, they're back in business. And that's what's happened year after year, and now it's all coming to a head because cities and towns and states all across America are starting to go bankrupt under the weight of the generations of wage increases and pension increases that unions have won for themselves. Public employees didn't used to be able to organize.
Right.
They had civil service protections. That was enough. It was only starting in the sort of last quarter of the 20th century that politicians gave them the right to organize, and that could be repealed.
I mean, would you support something like that?
I probably would support it, but I'm not making it a centerpiece of my campaign.
Okay.
Right now, I'll settle for a politician who can tell the unions no and make his bones by telling
the unions. How does that play with Democratic faithful?
The teachers' union part plays very well. Pretty much everybody hates the teachers' unions now. People who have kids in the public schools, people who are paying through the nose $20,000 a year to get out of the public schools, send their kids to private schools, hate the teachers' unions. I was at the Democratic convention. There was a whole sort of mini convention of charter school advocates who hated the teachers' unions, including four very charismatic black politicians, all of whom happened to be bald. Cory Booker, Adrian Fenty from here, from D.C., the mayor of Philadelphia, Nutter, and a Colorado politician who was head of the House there. They all didn't like the teachers' unions, And there were like hundreds of Democrats denouncing the teachers' unions at the Democratic convention.
Right.
So the other unions, I get much more hostility. But the teachers' unions.
And what
unions
I'm getting from this is you're a baldist. It seems to be the only thing that you talk about.
I was
about.
Trying to come up with a name for these bald politicians. Valdez was the best I could do.
What journalist running for office stunt most inspired you, and what which one do you think in the past has had the most impact, you know, on an actual political debate?
It's interesting. I wasn't looking at the past for inspiration. Mm-hmm. I mean, people say, oh, you should read William Buckley's book,
right?
Which I couldn't find in the library. I couldn't find it on sale. You could probably find it in the library. It's apparently very good about running for mayor.
Mm-hmm.
And he famously said, what would you do if they asked him what he would do mm-hmm. if he won? And he said he'd demand a recount.
Right.
Gore Vidal ran in California, got 11% of the vote.
Right.
That's pretty impressive, actually.
Yep. Norman Mailer ran. Jimmy Breslin.
None of those people, as far as I can see, had much of an impact on the debate.
Do you think Arianna Huffington did when she tried to jump into the recall, the gubernatorial recall in California?
She had an impact on the debate. I'm not so sure it's the debate, it's the impact, the net impact she wanted, wanted to have. I think her net impact was to help Schwarzenegger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but she helped mobilize her people,
mm-hmm.
And she became a much, much bigger figure, and that helped her start her business. But she's a powerful voice in national politics now. Certainly it helped her with that. But the immediate impact was that Schwarzenegger became popular because he put her down in a debate, and people sort of said, this is the decisive sort of guy we want.
That's right. And how was that working out for California?
Schwarzenegger's been a huge disappointment. The structural reason you like Schwarzenegger is because, yes, the legislature is controlled by Democratic interest groups, all these lobbies, mm-hmm. but he could go over the head of the legislature mm-hmm. to the people and get them to reverse the legislature. So we would have more power than the normal governor. He tried to do that, and he got his hat handed to him by the unions. So once that happened, he was emasculated. Mm-hmm. He became sort of half a Democrat.
Right.
The one thing he has achieved is to eliminate gerrymandering of districts, mm-hmm. a long-term structural reform of state districts that might be extended to congressional. In a state like California, that's a big deal. I've been disappointed.
Let's talk about new media. What prompted you? You started the Kaus Files in, 2000?
Earlier? 1999.
Yeah, what prompted you to do that? Because you had been a conventional kind of policy journalist, analyst. You'd written books. You worked for the New Republic.
Right. It's like with this campaign. It's sort of you see an opportunity mm-hmm. and you have nothing left to lose, so you take it. If I had a wife and kids and a mortgage, I wouldn't mm-hmm. be able to take a flyer on these things. Mm-hmm. I'd worked for Newsweek and for Slate, and in 98 I was through with the stint at Newsweek, and I couldn't get a job that I liked. I mean, there was no place I wanted to work that would hire me.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured, as a last resort, I'll just start slapping stuff up on the web and see what happens. And I sort of knew that Mike Kinsley at Slate had my back, that he would mm-hmm. buy the stuff.
Right.
And he eventually bought the whole, you know, the whole website went over.
Right.
The whole,
and Kaus Files became part of, what was it, Blog Central early on or something? I mean, it was you, Edward J. Epstein, Virginia Pastrell, and was it Andrew Sullivan?
I don't think so.
At some point that they had a clearinghouse.
Somebody may have done that to me, but I never.
Okay.
I don't think I'd ever participated.
So
I was a standalone website, and then I moved it. I rented it to mm-hmm. Slate. Now I've taken it back.
Mm-hmm.
But I was never part of any larger
and
consortium.
What happened to, how did Blogging Heads come about?
I told myself the problem, the advantages of blogging were no deadlines and no editors. The problem was no money and no readers.
Right.
But eventually the money and the readers came, so it all worked out.
How do you make money off of Kaus Files?
I don't make money now. Mm-hmm. I made money when it was part of Slate because Slate sold ads, and they gave me a chunk of it.
Okay.
They actually paid me a salary, and they took mm-hmm. the risk of would they sell the ads or not. But you could run it.
How do you support yourself then? Are you a male escort, as rumors have it, or?
It's weird. I told my salary to the New York Times, $82,000. Right?
Okay.
I thought people were going to say, "Kaus, you chump! Andrew Sullivan makes hundreds of thousands of dollars. Why are you making?" That wasn't the reaction. The reaction was, "How could they justify paying you that amount of money?"
Yeah.
But I can live on $80,000.
You get that from Slate?
I did. I've given that up, and I don't think it's coming back.
Right.
But because salaries are going down, not up.
Sure.
But
because of those unskilled Mexican bloggers.
No, because ad because web ads don't pay as much as everybody thought they would.
That's for sure. That's because they don't sell as much as everybody thought they would, right?
I can live on $80,000 a year.
Okay. What about blogging?
The mail escorting is just for fun.
I see. I understand that. You give it away.
Yeah.
Okay. Blogging Heads. How did that come about?
Blogging Heads was something Bob Wright and I had talked about for years about, hey, the next thing that's going to happen is somebody's going to start slapping video dialogues up on the web, and let's be the first.
Right.
It involved designing a crucial piece of software that lets you meld these two streams together. I tried to invent it in partnership with a friend of mine. We failed. Bob succeeded. Mm-hmm. So Bob controls the crucial piece of software, and it's his baby.
Yeah.
And I support him, and I'm part of it, but he has nurtured that whole thing.
Are you bullish? I mean, we live, and you are something of a pessimist, you evince a fearfulness of the future. Are you fearful about the future of media?
I'm not fearful about the future in general, I don't think. I think we're going to have unprecedented medical advances and wonderful things are going to happen.
Right.
And I think we will control the borders, and I think we will manage to have a tight labor market where everybody can make a decent living.
Right.
I even think the schools will get better eventually. Apparently in Washington, D.C., if you're in Northwest, you can actually send your kid to the public schools now. It's unprecedented for 20, because the mayor and Michelle Rhee have done a good job.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm pretty optimistic.
Are you optimistic about media? I mean, we live in an age of unrelenting media sob stories. Everything's dying. It's over.
Well, the conventional media is dying, but I think people will be able to get the information they need, and there'll be more of it, and it'll get to them more quickly. I'm a blogger. I think bloggers are good. I think they've... Even as they've helped destroy, paid opinion journalism, and also are helping to destroy, conventional mainstream media, the net effect is better than what was there before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the New York Times no longer has a stranglehold on what the public finds out about. So I'm reasonably optimistic. Somebody has to do investigative reporting. It's very expensive. So that moves to the universities, and it becomes the graduate school of the Michael Isikoff graduate school of journalism.
Some nonprofits are funding investigative journalism? Pacific Research Institute in San Francisco hired a couple of guys from the Orange County Register.
That's all good. And Ariana's actually hired some pretty good journalists. So there'll be new sources of investigative journalism. I mean, it just is expensive because, as you know, you can investigate a story for 6 months and it falls through.
That's right.
And you have nothing.
Yeah.
Okay? So it's not like blogging where you post 3 items a day, however crappy they are.
That's right.
And you know you're going to get something for your money.
Right. $82,000, last time I checked. Talk about, let's get to the most important thing. You got the Velvet Underground to play at your high school. What was your high school and what year were you talking about?
I went to Beverly Hills High School, something I can never mention on the campaign trail. It's like death. Beverly Hills High School is just like Scarsdale West. It's with a few movie stars, but it's basically a rich Jewish high school.
Mm-hmm.
Very good rich Jewish high school.
Right.
At least it was when I went there. I went to the Shrine. This was the early days of POD in 1968, I guess, or 7. I went to the Shrine Auditorium and saw this group, the Velvet Underground.
Right.
They were, what Jonathan Richman says about them is true. There are four people dressed in black, standing there very formally, making this incredible sound, this infernal machine of sound. How the hell did they make that much sound? And they were very charismatic. The songs were tuneful, and I thought Lou Reed was charismatic, and I just loved them. So then I was a politician in my youth, and I was student body president, and I decided, why not try to get these guys to come to the high school?
Mm-hmm.
They were in town, so I called up the Whiskey a Go-Go. They transferred me to the motel where they were staying. I called the motel. This was the day after they recorded their third album.
Mm-hmm.
Their manager, who was a totally crazy man, swore to the girls' vice principal that there were no drug references in any of their songs.
Okay.
I'm Waiting for My Man is just about a homosexual pickup. Nothing
to
do with drugs.
Okay,
nothing
that's
to do with
correct,
drugs.
Yeah.
And she bought this. And I later got the distractor while they were singing Heroin on stage.
Yeah.
So they showed up. You remember they were a failed band.
Right.
So they were desperate to have an audience.
Did
so
you
they
pay
thought,
them?
They thought this,
or?
I don't think we paid them. If we paid them, it was like $150. Right.
Yeah.
And they came and they were like, they had just finished the album the night before. I don't think they'd gone to sleep. Mm-hmm. Maybe there was some drugs were involved. I don't know. They played very well. Then we had a panel discussion with the Velvet Underground and the school psychiatrist, me, and the leader of the school marching band. Okay. This was like, I wish I had a film of this.
Yeah.
And Lou Reed and the psychiatrist got this incredible pissing match. Lou Reed said, the psychiatrist said, well, I dig your music, but it's too loud.
Yeah.
It hurts lab rats. And Lou Reed said, well, you know, if I was a lab rat, maybe I'd care or something.
Yeah.
And they just hated each other, and they were all jerks. Lou Reed and everybody else was a jerk. And it was considered a disaster. Because they weren't getting along,
right,
they were supposed to have sweetness and light, and there was contention. But in retrospect, it was a neat thing.
I thought you were going to say it was the high point of your life.
It was the high point of my life, Nick, but I didn't say that because that would be pessimistic about the future. And I'm optimistic.
Do you, I mean, you're growing up in Beverly Hills in the late 60s. I mean, do any of your fears to bring it back to immigration, you know, that may well have been the apex of a white assimilationist America. I mean, because your parents were, how many generations are you into
America?
It's
only the apex because we've given up on the idea of assimilation.
No, but I mean, because I don't, the Mexicans I know, if they've been around for more than 15 minutes, they're pretty assimilated. But what I'm saying is, like, you, Southern California, where I lived in Southern California for 3 years, and there seemed to be a fixation on a moment that you took as normal, which was kind of the late 60s or maybe very early 70s, where it was a glorious high point for Southern California, and it just seems like the world has moved on from there. I mean, do you ever feel like you're chasing after a vision of America that was momentary but happened to coincide with a particular moment?
The whole post-war boom is a moment that Americans would like to recapture all the time. I mean, because it was a period of unprecedented growth and prosperity. We came out of the Depression, and all of a sudden created this wonderful, orderly, middle-class society.
But you're looking through, rose-colored glasses, because the 1950s were not, people living there, it was Johnny couldn't read, the Ruskies were about to tap dance down Pennsylvania Avenue, homosexuals were everywhere, beats were everywhere, drugs were everywhere.
Did you have a problem with those last 3 days?
No, not at all. What I'm saying is that the post-war boom, we look back now and say, like, oh, it was beautiful, it was wonderful, everything was peaceful. The civil rights movement was going on, you know, and then the 60s came, then the 70s, and things got really shitty, and then it was Reagan, and we're,
the 60s were, if you look at the economic charts, which I did when I was writing my book, everything goes to hell in 1975.
Right.
Okay? People aren't crazy. You know, if you look at the inequality curve, the wage increase curve, something bad happens in the economy in 1975. People aren't crazy to want to go back.
But the inequality is not necessarily that. I mean, in the sense that it, you know, there's no question that people now are, even poor people are much wealthier than middle class people were in 1970 in terms of amenities in the home.
Right, but the growth.
They have cars, they have TVs, they have homes, they have washing machines.
The growth, the people's incomes kept rising, but they were rising much more dramatically. Progress seemed to be coming much more rapidly before 75 than after. I mean, since then, it's been fits and starts.
Right.
But people aren't crazy to want to go back to the pre-75 era. It was an unprecedented era of prosperity, and people say it's a fluke.
1970.
Because of World War II, our enemies were in ruins. Well, who wants... It's a great fluke. People want to go back to the fluke.
In 1970, there was also a moment where the foreign-born percentage of the population in America was at a historic low. For the previous 70 years, it had always been higher. It bottomed out there basically in the very late 60s, early 70s, and sort of picking up again. I mean, how much of it was that there was that momentary pause where the Italians, the Poles, the Irish, the Jews had been assimilated and the new people hadn't come in yet?
I've never thought of it that way. It may well be more comfortable to live in a society where everybody's been assimilated.
But it was also, it's fascinating to me to think about it in terms of, you know, The Godfather, written in 68, became a movie in 72, which recast the American, origin story as an Italian-American story. It had been done as a Jewish story before that and as a black story, et cetera. And that we only had that moment where we could all kind of be like, okay, yeah, everybody, we can talk about our ethnicity now that we're all really American. But that's a brief pause, and that the story of America is really constant influx of new and different people, and it causes anxiety. But it doesn't cause crime. It doesn't cause disorder. It doesn't cause decline.
Well, it depends who the immigrants are. If they're Marielitos, they caused a lot of crime. Mm-hmm. Now they've assimilated, but initially they were people released from jails in Cuba. They're not the best people. I guess I don't quite understand your point. There was a point at which, the rise of the unmeltable ethnic,
which was a joke. That book came out at exactly the moment when precisely the people, the Poles, the Italians, the Irish, had been totally assimilated.
Right. But that's why it was a contrarian book at the time. And the idea was, it's okay to think of yourself as a Pole. It's okay to think of yourself as Italian. Which I sort of bridled at the time, but that got then transformed into multiculturalism, which is there are inalterable differences between Poles, Mexicans, and Italian. And I remember the point at the 60s when I was a Marxist, when all these crazy radicals came and started talking about multiculturalism, and we thought they were insane. There's the proletariat and there's the capitalist, proletariat are all the same. Don't try to pretend that Italian Poles are different than black Poles are different from Mexican Poles. And this was like a horrible, revisionist counter-revolutionary movement, but it then dominated. So now we have
that state enforced difference, which would go away if the policies did, I think.
It's, I don't know. You run into these assistant professors from universities, and their whole thing is to try to gin up some ethnic tension and. No. And there are a whole lot of institutions that have a vested stake in multiculturalism.
Well, we're going to leave it there, but thank you, Mickey, for talking.
Good luck
in your bid.
Thank you. I know you're sincere about
that. Your bid to win
the
Senate, not to enforce a border wall or a horrifying kind of neo-East German state in America, but all good things on the other counts, please.
Okay.
For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie. We've been talking with Mickey Kaus of the Kaus Files, of Blogging Heads, and now a candidate for Senate in California.
Thanks.